From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. On the show today, Hollywood's political donor class has yet to settle on a favorite Democratic presidential candidate, but a lot of money is being spread around. Then, composer Anthony Davis on why the harrowing odyssey of the Central Park Five is a story made for the opera stage.
The music takes you through this journey, their journey, to think about your kid or think about you as a child, and to be thrown into the situation in which all these people are convinced you're guilty of something that you didn't do.
And how guitarist and songwriter Steve Gunn helped revive a Japanese folk singer's career. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Game of Thrones. Critics have hailed the final season as TV's greatest show of all time, and era-defining, Emmy-eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. A number of Democratic candidates for president have swept through Los Angeles in recent weeks, taking in hundreds of thousands of dollars in big donor cash along the way. Kamala Harris and Joe Biden attended ritzy Hollywood fundraisers in the spring. The Biden event was co-hosted by Hollywood mogul Jeffrey Katzenberg. He also helped coordinate a private fundraiser for former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke last night. Ted Johnson covers the intersection of Hollywood and politics, and he says it's part of a larger trend among industry power players this election cycle. Many are still hanging back before throwing their support behind any one candidate.
It seems to be common, more common than any recent cycle, for Katzenberg and some of those other top bundlers to kind of withhold their exclusive support and to spread their money around. You can call it hedging, you can call it hesitancy, or you can call it they just want to keep these candidates or help keep these candidates as viable as possible until it becomes clearer who is probably the best position to take on Donald Trump.
And a bundler, for those who don't know, a bundler means what?
A bundler is essentially a fundraiser. Because the contribution limit is only $2,800 for the primary, $2,800 for the general election, if you're an individual donor, that's the max that you can give. So because of those limits, campaigns start to depend on what they call bundlers, and those are people who have a good circle of connections to people who can write checks.
So you spoke with someone who attended last night's Beto O'Rourke fundraiser. What did you learn about how it went?
Well, it was a lot different than, say, a Joe Biden fundraiser, which was described as kind of formal and where there were hundreds of people there and there was a stage in a backyard and Biden came out and spoke at a microphone. At this event, it was a little more intimate. There was about 200 people there. Beto didn't even use a microphone. And afterward, he kind of made a point of staying around and meeting with anyone who wanted to have, you know, a one-on-one conversation with him.
Mayor Pete Buttigieg was also scheduled to attend a big fundraiser this week, co-hosted by some pretty powerful LGBTQ Hollywood players. He had to cancel. But I'm wondering why so many were willing to attend and fork over, apparently, a minimum of $1,500 per ticket to attend.
Well, this is a historic moment in the LGBT community, especially in Hollywood, where they have become extraordinarily influential when it comes to presidential politics. And here is the first viable out gay candidate to come along. And so there's a tremendous amount of enthusiasm out there for Mayor Pete. In fact, he had six different events hosted by gay and straight bundlers scheduled before he canceled. They're going to be rescheduled. The reason he canceled is he had to get back to South Bend and deal with the crisis because there was an officer involved shooting of a black man.
Right.
He had to kind of deal with the fallout of that. So that's why he made the decision to cancel. But from everything I hear, they'll be rescheduled into July.
You write about some gay donors in Hollywood still being a little bit hesitant about Mayor Pete. What are their concerns?
Well, I think there's concerns over how he expands his base, how he reaches the African-American community, essential for getting the Democratic nomination. And then they also are wondering how he scales up his campaign. He's had this big fundraising haul. Now he can, and especially in those early states. And finally, he's 37 years old. He's new on the scene. somewhat untested. So I think they want to wait and see how he performs in the debates, maybe even how he performs in some of those early states.
Right. Well, other Democratic candidates have swept through Los Angeles in recent weeks and months, most notably Joe Biden and Kamala Harris in the spring. Both also raised a lot of money. How would you gauge where support is for those two candidates right now? It seems, from my perspective, that it's leaning more towards Kamala Harris. But what's your analysis?
I see it as essentially going to three different candidates by and large, and that is to Kamala Harris, as you said, Joe Biden definitely, and also to Pete Buttigieg. I say that by judging the sheer number of events that these candidates have had. Before Buttigieg canceled, he had six different events on the books, most of them aimed at the entertainment community, which is quite a few to have in one visit through LA. But those three seem to be the ones that people are talking about. However, other candidates do have a base of support. There's a screenwriter, Billy Ray, who's going to be hosting an event for Michael Bennett, the senator from Colorado. Steve Bullock is in town, and he has Jane Fonda on as a co-host of his event. So it's not over yet. I think it's very much open to a candidate to kind of win over Hollywood. The big story so far is just that there's so many donors who say, we have so many candidates sweeping through town, I'm just not ready to make up my mind.
Well, there's also, too, from my perspective, it appears that there is still a lot of support for progressive candidates like Bernie Sanders, and now also for Elizabeth Warren.
They do have significant support within the entertainment industry. The thing is, they haven't made the visit, so they don't.
Right.
They're not talked about as much. Elizabeth Warren, one reason she's kind of shunning these high-profile fundraisers, so they don't get the same amount of buzz, although lately I have to say that I've heard more people talk about Elizabeth Warren, and there is a strand within the entertainment community that is saying, hey, we need to shun these kind of corporate ties in any of our candidates,
right.
And you hear that not just from more of the younger part of Hollywood, but people like Adam McKay, Oscar-winning screenwriter, he's also been out there for Bernie. So you hear that from some important voices in the industry.
Ted Johnson is a contributor to Politico and SiriusXM. Ted, thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
You can read Ted Johnson's story about Pete Buttigieg at politico.com. Coming up on The Frame, for composer Anthony Davis, the story of the Central Park Five could only be told in a full-scale opera.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Sharp Objects, based on the best-selling novel by Gillian Flynn. The story focuses on Camille Preaker, a journalist with a history of psychiatric issues who returns to her rural hometown to cover the apparent murders of two preteen girls. The limited series was hailed by critics as exquisite, hauntingly compelling, and a true masterpiece. Emmy eligible for Outstanding Limited Series and all other categories. Visit hbo.com/FYC for more on Sharp Objects.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. Thanks for joining us. And now a warning. The next segment contains references to sexual assault. It's been 30 years since the infamously violent rape of a jogger in New York City's Central Park. But the wrongful conviction of five young Black and Latino teenagers and how they were vilified by the police and the press remains ever relevant.
Roaming gangs of teenagers attack a 28-year-old woman, hitting her with fists and rocks. Four of them rape her and leave her there unconscious.
For nearly 4 years, composer Anthony Davis has been set on exploring the story and its themes of race and justice. Long Beach Opera is presenting the world premiere of Davis's The Central Park Five. Anthony Davis told me his musical influences are usually more in the worlds of Ellington and Stravinsky, but for the Central Park Five opera, he also became immersed in the music of the time.
Hip-hop really went mainstream in 1989,
right.
You know, with Back on the Block and Public Enemy and the release of Do the Right Thing. And so I began to think about how I could incorporate that musical language into mine. You know, I decided not to do, you know, hip-hop lyrics, et cetera, but,
right.
but to use the speech rhythm and aspect of it, particularly in We Are the Freaks.
We are the freaks. We are the freaks who run the night.
Which is a George Clinton reference, yeah?
Yes, it's definitely referring to George Clinton, yeah. And that's the way hip-hop traditionally borrows also from earlier forms of African-American popular music. So I was sort of curious to do that. So in a way of doing a parody of something that the hip-hop itself would draw from.
It seemed to my ears that the first half of the opera, the music seemed much more discordant than the second half. And I should say in the first half, it's the period in the story where this jogger is attacked, the boys are arrested, they're interrogated. And then in the second half, we move into the trial and the aftermath.
I think part of it is that in the first half of the opera, you see a lot of the interrogation begins. And the interrogation is, I looked at it as a manipulation. So in effect, using the rhythmic aspect of the music, it propels the district attorney and the mask figure in their interrogation of the Central Park Five. So a lot of it is creating that stress through the rhythmic tension. And then there are lyrical moments, certainly, you know, when no one's smiling anymore, you know, when they sing together. There's sort of there's sections where they're almost drawing from Take Six and some of the vocal groups of the 80s and stuff, you know, using close harmony and using that kind of harmony for the voices. And so some lyricism comes out of that. And also in a sense of so we feel empathy for them, what they're feeling when during this whole process of the trial and the way they play on their fears.
You worked with the librettist Richard Wesley on this work. Can you talk about what was involved in developing the voices of the main characters, of the boys, these boys aged like 14 to 16? So it, you know, really reflected who they were at the time.
That was an interesting problem because, you know, in a way, when we first approached it, we were thinking of having, you know, double cast, have the young Central Park Five and try to cast closer to their age and then the older Central Park Five. But that became too complicated. That was way too complicated. And then we thought about, you know, eventually to have them as the older Central Park Five, about what their ages would be now, reflecting back and then sort of inhabiting their younger selves.
I did wonder why you did not use teenagers.
It was interesting because also opera doesn't have to be realistic in the same way that, you know, I mean, you would never do this, for example, for the Netflix piece, that everything has to be sort of like reflect reality in a different way. In an opera, it was also to have the mature voice. So in a way, it's that they're reflecting from the present back to the past and then inhabiting those people, what they were when this all happened. It's almost like their memory of it rather than necessarily a literal translation of having children in this situation.
Mm-hmm. Anthony Davis is the composer of the new opera, The Central Park Five. Well, the opera's been in production for a while, but the premiere now comes on the heels of Ava DuVernay's four-part series from Netflix, documenting what happened. Her series and your opera could have come at almost any time, really, in the last 10 or 12 years. Why do you think now is the time to revisit this story, and why do you think it's resonating with so many people?
Well, I think one of the factors is the election of Donald Trump. I mean, we now have a person in power whose political career began with the Central Park Five. That's where he started. That's where his whole playbook of using race and using racial division, using the rhetoric, kind of rhetoric that he uses, began. And we saw that in the presidential campaign. And he still refuses to apologize or acknowledge that the Central Park Five were innocent.
He doubled down on it.
He does. As does Linda Fairstein,
the prosecutor.
There was no physical evidence tying them to the rape and assault. So it's kind of outrageous that she still holds that view.
In one scene in the opera, we hear the character of Trisha Miley, who was the jogger who was assaulted and raped and nearly lost her life. We don't see her, but I believe it's in the trial sequence, and she's giving testimony. We only hear her voice from offstage singing. Why did you choose to have her be heard but not seen?
because we were more interested in the effect of the fact that she didn't remember, couldn't remember what happened, that the disappointment of the five that she didn't remember, because they were hoping that they would be exonerated because of her testimony.
And you depict that in
yes,
the opera.
Yes. And I think it's really chilling when you see Matias Reyes and when he confesses.
This
is some operatic license when I have Matias Reyes meet Corey Wise in prison. They actually did meet in Rikers Island, but yeah. much earlier. So I had this where he sees him in prison and you realize that he's trying to tell him that he's the one who committed the crime. He doesn't get to, but he eventually tells the mask character, confesses to the mask. And that's what led to their exoneration.
The mask is this character that acts in a way as the narrator, but who also takes on different roles as the opera
Well, he's
progresses.
A reporter, he's yeah. a policeman, he's for the prosecution, and also he's kind of the voice of racial animus, this kind of attitude about looking at the people of Harlem as the other, almost as, you know, these other people he looks at with disdain.
Mm. You also really portray what the press was saying at the time and how they were depicting these five boys in the press. Including, we see superimposed behind the performers actual headlines from some of the daily
exactly.
newspapers that essentially prosecuted them in the daily press.
And that's where Salam's aria comes into play, because she's responding to their basically convicting her son, Yusef, in the press. The Daily News and the Post and a lot of the tabloids in New York with the headlines, and certainly Donald Trump was a big part of that too, with his full-page ad that he took out. So they were basically convicting them in the press before the trial even was completed. So she's responding to that. So I was imagining almost like she was being interviewed. I might be a New York One interview, one of those. And she was an activist in this whole situation.
Right.
Even after they went to jail, she continued the fight to try to get their freedom. And that was very important. She was a school teacher in New York. She was very involved. And you can see the kind of the genesis of the Black Lives Matter movement out of that.
What would you like to say to someone who may be hearing this and have tickets to the opera? What would you like to say to them in terms of preparation? Because the subject matter is difficult. What we see on stage is difficult to watch at times. And the music reflects that.
I think the music is propulsive and the music takes you through this journey, their journey. And it's as if you're identifying with the five, to think about your kid or think about you as a child, and to be thrown into this situation in which all these people are convinced you're guilty of something that you didn't do. To me, the rhythm is very important, and that could be speech rhythm, how you set text. At the same time, then I have these quiet sections, for example, with Corey's aria that comes in later. I hope it's fulfilling in the sense that you see the music unfold over the course of 2 hours, in which there's thematic material that recurs and returns, and hopefully to an emotional effect.
Anthony Davis is the composer of the new opera, The Central Park Five, produced by the Long Beach Opera and on stage now at the Warner Grand Theater in San Pedro. Anthony, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
The final performances of The Central Park Five are this weekend, June 22nd and 23rd. Coming up on The Frame, musician Steve Gunn has a chance encounter with one of his heroes. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. For the guitarist and songwriter Steve Gunn, part of the joy in making music comes from meeting his musical heroes. Not too long ago, he produced a record for British folk rock veteran Michael Chapman. The album reintroduced Chapman's music to a younger generation. On his latest record, The Unseen In Between, Gunn collaborated with Bob Dylan's longtime bassist and musical director, Tony Garnier. Gunn spoke with producer Jonathan Shiflett about another collaboration, this time with a Japanese folk singer.
Hi, my name is Steve Gunn. I am a guitar player and singer, originally from Philadelphia. I came up with the idea of writing the song Vagabond after I saw the film named Vagabond for the probably 10th time, made by Agnes Varda. And I was thinking about this character in the film.
Mona came from the sea, caught land gracefully. The night is cold, but you know it felt so free.
Almost in real time, she kind of takes this journey and meets all these people, and just the story of how she just is kind of a wanderer and she's sort of moving through these different landscapes. I tend to write a lot about traveling, and you know, I travel quite a bit. You have to kind of give up a certain part of yourself to just the unknown, I guess. For me, I really enjoy where things happen randomly. You sit next to someone in a cafe and you have this incredible conversation, or you come across a photograph in a museum, and I try to kind of sing about those kinds of things. I listen to this station based out of New Jersey called WFMU all the time, and actually learned about this Japanese folk singer named Sachiko Kaninobu, who moved here to the States in the 70s. And she recorded this amazing record that was sort of a collector's item amongst record nerds and enthusiasts. And the album's called Mizora, which means sky in Japanese. And it's very sort of atmospheric and just really, really nice, really beautiful. And I was driving one day about a year ago, listening to WFMU, and there was Sachiko in the station, being interviewed by a friend of mine, and she was sort of telling her life story and talking about this album that I didn't own it, it's very expensive, but I've, you know, been listening to, like, files of it for years. It was just this quite an incredible story. You know, she moved from Japan in the early 70s, she married this music journalist named Paul Williams, who had a magazine called Crawl Daddy. He was one of the first people to do intimate interviews with people like Bob Dylan. And so she was with this guy, Paul, and they were living in New York in like Soho in the 70s. And so she was hanging out with Dylan and she was surrounded by all these people. They moved to California, raised a family. And she kind of just didn't really play much after that. Anyway, so I was driving and I heard this interview. It blew me away. She even did a live performance. And I also knew the DJ. So I wrote to the DJ. I said, that was such a cool interview.
Sachiko, thanks so much for doing that great live set for us.
Oh, it was great. Great fun.
And then fast forward about a week, unrelated to any of the radio stuff, this friend of mine from San Francisco said, hey, you know, I knew this woman, Sachiko, when I was living in San Francisco kind of in the 80s, and I just spoke to her. I asked her what she was listening to, and guess what? She said, Your Name. And I told him, I said, that's so weird because I was just sharing this interview and all this stuff. So he said, well, you should reach out to her, you know. He gave me her phone number and I texted her and she immediately texted me back.
It's all right here on the floor.
And it just so happened that I was traveling to California like that in a few weeks and playing in Sonoma, which is very close to where she lived, at a music festival. Anyway, so I invited her to the festival and she came with me. And we just kind of became fast friends and kept in touch.
It's such a thrill to have you here in person at WFMU after hearing your records on WFMU for so many years. Tell us a little bit about what's happening for you.
It's kind of strange, and why this happening, I'm questioning myself. Why this happening in my age? This light attic?
Light in the attic?
Light in the attic. they released this compilation CD.
So she's back now. The album's getting reissued, and there's sort of a new appreciation for it. And she's writing songs again and really excited about everything. So I'm going to try to help her make another record, and we're talking about playing more concerts together, and I hope to go to Japan with her and, you know, see if she wants to perform a bit more. She's quite a good singer and guitar player. And so it's pretty sweet. She's 70 now. I mean, for me, that's an important aspect of traveling and being a musician and feeling, you know, grateful to be able to meet people that I admire, feel inspired by them, but also, you know, pay respects and make them still be engaged with what they did in the past and what they're doing now.
Steve Gunn's albums are available on streaming services, and Sachiko Kaninobu performs tonight at the music venue Zebulon in Silver Lake. And that's it for today. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.
Watashi no kata ni hato ga ichi wo ashi.